Unlike most economists, Sir Alan Walters was often headline news in the 1980s. Now 75, he lives in London near St James's Park and works as a consultant in the city. Few economists have combined distinguished academic careers on both sides of the Atlantic with a ringside seat at the heart of government. He has published extensively in the field of economic statistics, public sector pricing, and cost-benefit analysis, often with pioneering results. He has taught at the University of Birmingham, as Cassell Professor at the LSE, and at John Hopkins University. He has advised the World Bank and two Tory Prime Ministers, Ted Heath and Margaret Thatcher. To discuss these and other aspects of his career, he was joined by fellow economist and director of the IEA, John Blundell. They met at Sir Alan's home in Mayfair.
You've written, if I may quote you, that from your earliest days you were drawn to that peculiar analysis, interpretation of evidence, and imaginative invention so characteristic of policy analysis and prescription. It seems that the policy wonk was in you from the very start.
I think it was. I never identified... Well, I did identify that damn old paper I wrote when I was an undergraduate, actually, on pricing policy. I was there then, I think. Oddly enough, I never thought of it in those terms, but it was, I'm sure.
It was at Birmingham in the 50s that you became a market liberal. What attracted you to market ideas?
I suppose I think it was much earlier. I think it was revolt against my father's ideas, you know. But it became increasingly attractive in Birmingham, largely because of, I think, in my case anyway, the amazing work of Gilbert Walker. Gilbert Walker wouldn't appear in no glory list of English economics, but I think he should do. And your origin was it really is his work on called Road and Rail. Because what he showed there was unequivocally the regulation of the transport industry gave rise to the opposite results to those which were intended. And he did this, saw the spade work to show this, legal work and everything else. It was remarkable. He was saying we'd be much better off if we eliminated regulation, allowed free entry into the industry.
You once said it was the free spirits of Birmingham of the 1950s led to you acquiring a taste for being an enfant terrible.
Well, you had to, yes. I mean, the great thing was if you could argue your corner against them, you know, you could argue a corner more or less against anybody because they were so good. They got such incisive brains, particularly Gorman, but also Hahn and Michael Beazley. And another great liberal there was Arthur Shenfield and Barbara, of course. But it was, you know, nest in that rather small department, a nest of, you know, five people who never believed in liberal economics.
Early on, you seem to have bought the not just the efficiency argument for markets, but also the insight that markets are a pillar, if you like, of a tolerant liberal society.
I think that's true. I think probably the basis of it was people, you know, there should be ground rules which say people shouldn't do this, but in general, you should leave a lot of open space for people to do what they like, if it doesn't very badly affect some other people. And so I think the general view was that liberty was the essential quality we were looking for in a society, not democracy. Democracy, you can have all sorts of onerous societies, obnoxious societies indeed, but liberty was the fundamental thing.
You've made contributions in many areas of economics. The first was in the field of public sector pricing, public utility pricing, where you worked on particularly the pricing of road services. What was the prevailing paradigm that you set out to conquer there?
Well, it was an old paradigm. It went back many years. And broadly speaking, it said that people should pay for the use of the roads, or the use of the railroads, for that matter. they should pay, roughly speaking, the average cost of using them. So those roads which were sort of highly, you know, highly congested roads had a lot of people paying for them, so the amount that you pay for them was low. The average cost was low. Other roads where there was little traffic, but very expensive roadbeds, of course, they should be charged high amounts, a larger amount of money for those, for the use of the roads. So broadly speaking, it was an average cost criterion. I wrote in 1953, my first article on this was, say no, the opposite is true. And I advocated a system of area licensing for congested roads, which was later taken up by Singapore.
So you said it was the short-run marginal cost that was...
I said it's, well, you see, pricing in the private sector is at short-run marginal cost under competitive conditions. Why shouldn't that be true in the public sector?
Now, Singapore adopted your ideas in 1975, I believe.
Yes, that's right.
And that's been quite a successful and very gratifying for you.
Yes, it's been a great success. And you can now move around Singapore. You can drive your car in Singapore. Hitherto, before they had road pricing, it was very difficult to drive your car in Singapore because of the congestion. So it opened up the centre, CBD of Singapore.
Your work on road pricing led you to be invited to be the only economist, actually, on the Roskill Commission, looking at the future for London's airports. And you laid great emphasis there on using the pricing mechanism to allocate landing slots, which was quite a new idea. How did this all work out?
It worked out quite well. I think it wasn't just, of course, pricing on the roads, but these ideas were generally about pricing of public utilities, public services, and so on. But the interesting thing about the Roskill Commission was, within 6 weeks, a couple of months, I'm not sure, quite quickly, we realised by doing simple arithmetic on the cost-benefit, most simple elementary arithmetic, that it would be wasteful to have another airport, even another two runways. It would be wasteful if it was done in the next 10 years. In other words, we didn't need any additional capacity for 10 years. This is a fundamental result because it occurs wherever I've seen new airport investment has been proposed.
So better use of the space by using the pricing mechanism?
Better use by using the pricing mechanism, indeed.
Your desire to tilt at windmills next led you into monetary economics. And here we had some very exciting debates going on because on the one hand, there was Milton Friedman and the quantity theory of money. And on the other hand, there was the Radcliffe report that said that quantity wasn't at all important because velocity could vary so much. How did you come to get involved in this?
Well, are these all windmills? I'm not sure. partly because of my political connections, I believe, and partly, of course, because of the born birth of monetary economics in Britain. For instance, I got interested in Milton Friedman's work. I think we go back a bit here. When he gave a paper in the celebrated seminar in Birmingham in 1954 on his work on the consumption function.
What would you say is the essence of the monetarist approach?
Well, you define it as monetarism. Monetarism really is saying money matters, you can't ignore it.
There's always seemed to me to be a lot of disputes between monetary economists about exactly what should be targeted. And they talk about broad money and narrow money. Mm. Are these differences important?
Well, I had a bit of a role in this because I did research into both of them in the 50s and 60s, early 60s. Didn't matter whether you had broad money or narrow money then, they both moved in lockstep. They got a bit out of step, but not very much, in the 1970-74 period. I think that has been, you know, the distinction between broad money and narrow money and its implications has, I think, been overdone by some scholars.
Which do you track now?
I always have tracked both. You see, I think it got into trouble when there was deregulation. See, things go in lockstep when you've got regulation. But there was deregulation of the monetary, called competition and credit control. And that saw them move out of step, because there was a step movement, if you may say so, to a new sort of arrangement.
Of course, this debate became very public in the early 70s when we had the great Heath inflation and,
yes,
and prices were going up at close on 30% a year. I recall that era vividly, and I recall very few voices, though. I recall you, the academic, Nicholas Ridley, the politician, Andrew Alexander, the journalist, the IEA, of course, bringing Milton Friedman over. That was quite a debate in the early 70s.
Yes, I think it's important to go back to the basic methodological differences on that debate, because in the late 60s, indeed running into the 70s, the prevailing view among macroeconomists in Britain, epitomised, I suppose, in Nicholas Cawdor, Lord Cawdor, was that the way to control the economy was through fiscal policy. Monetary policy was something that should be adjusted so that it's consistent with fiscal policy, but fiscal policy really drives it. Cawdor said that monetary policy is rather like my trousers. You know, when I get fat, I adjust my trousers by expanding the belt. When I get thin, I pull the belt in. But I don't do that in order to get fat or in order to get thin. So Cawdor looked upon this then as fiscal policy was important. Monetary policy was something which you can leave to the Bank of England to ensure, you know, gilt-edged securities are marketed properly and so on. Now, my research over the 60s convinced me that this was wrong. It convinced me that fiscal policy was indeed, under many circumstances, perverse. You get the opposite result to that which you intended. That monetary policy really mattered a lot, and it wasn't perverse. We factored in unemployment here and all the other sort of aspects of the macroeconomic equations. But the basic result was that fiscal policy was untrustworthy, to say the least. Monetary policy was much more important, mattered much more. True, it had great lags in its operation, which limited it severely as a sort of planning operator. That was the basis of the ideas that had formed by then. These were, I think, supported also by Gordon Pepper and other monetarists. So we began the 70s then, when the Conservative government came in the mid-1970s. We thought, and Mr. Heath, through Walter Rothschild, asked me to be a macroeconomic advisor in the government. We thought that these ideas were firmly planted in the civil service, in the Bank of England, and so on. We should have known better. Indeed, they weren't at all. And what happened was that in order to combat growing unemployment and the downturn in the economy, Heath embarked on a massive expansion of the economy, mainly through monetary expansion, which began, I think, about 1972, really, late 1971, pretty much as soon as he got in. But that was the beginning of, in my view, the beginning of the end of Heath.
You had earlier engaged in debates with Milton Friedman, the dean of all monetarist economists, and in fact, in a 1965 article, You confronted him on the whole issue of the demand for money. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yes, that was, again, a methodological article, which was of some importance. Friedman had done a lot of work with Anna Schwartz. It was very important here, which he published in 1963 on the multipliers, which is what we were talking about. Now, what Friedman had done had measured the demand for money as the money depending upon income. But I said, my argument was, no, the point is that income depends upon money. So I reversed it. It's causality. It had all sorts of implications, especially in terms of the hypotheses he was pursuing then, which went back to 1954, actually, the permanent income hypothesis, he called it. So it had all sorts of implications for that. And you had to interpret the results in quite a different way. It didn't upset the major contribution there that money really mattered. It did mean you've got to look at it statistically in terms of the monetary multipliers, that is, money affecting income, not the quantity of money responding to income changes.
But in 1967, you relocated to London to take a very prestigious chair at the London School of Economics. And of course, immediately there, your colleagues would have been great men such as Harry Johnson, Lionel Robbins, Basil Yamy, Peter Bauer. That must have been terrifically exciting.
Together with our old friends from Birmingham, Gorman and Hahn.
Oh, they had moved ahead of you?
They had moved just ahead of me.
So did the locus of economic thinking in Britain then very much move
yes,
to LSE?
Yes, moved to LSE. One fell swoop, really. Michael Beasley moved to London Business School.
What was it like in the common room with, I just envy you of having been there with Lionel Robbins and Basil Yamy and Peter Bauer.
Well, it was great. I mean, I enjoyed the LSE enormously. One of the lions there was Harry Johnson, with his enormous energy and enormous output, and his desire to convert LSE into a mini Chicago school. In addition to my new friends from Birmingham, I got to know, Basil Yamy I knew, I think, fairly well, but I got to know Peter Bauer very well indeed. We wrote a couple of articles, three articles, I think, together, or maybe four.
What were your hopes for the new Heath government that came to power in 1970 and to which, of course, you were a part-time advisor on macro policy?
Well, I thought we'd heard from Heath before. He'd talked about his policies. I believed that he meant what he said, because he said he would conduct disciplined fiscal policy. He'd restrain monetary growth. Disciplined monetary policy. He would deregulate substantially, all these things. And we looked at it, later in 1979 and say, well, it's like what Mrs. Thatcher, resuscitation of 1970s Heath. So he was saying all the right things. He was rather like a Thatcher. Different emphasis in places, but one I could entirely live with. So I was quite happy to advise him. I advised, incidentally, Keith Joseph at the same time, but that was on health services. But Heath was my main target on
macro policy. Macro. Mm-hmm. But in 1971, Mr. Heath embarked on a series of disastrous U-turns. You wrote him a famous memo. What did you say and what did he do in response?
Well, the memo was simple, and it was dated, I think, January, or maybe December 1971. And it made the following three points. It said, you've expanded the money supply at such a rate that my forecast is you'll have an inflation of at least 10% and probably 15% by 1974, number one. Secondly, you'll be driven to control prices and incomes. And you've said, of course, in the past that you'll never control price and incomes. My view is you'll be driven to it. Thirdly, you'll have a balance of payments deficit of incredibly large dimensions, over £1 billion sterling. I think it's disastrous, this policy. He called me in and said, all my other advisors are saying the inflation rate is going down from 6% to 4%. You say it's going up to 15%. I said, yes, I'm perfectly convinced of this. I've never seen a set of circumstances like this that hasn't resulted in dramatic inflation. My professional judgment is on the line here. And he said, I'll never go back. I'll never have price and incomes controls. I said, well, my judgment is you'll be driven to it by the rate of inflation and so on. And a balance of payments deficit on current account of £1 billion? I said, yes, that's my judgment. So he said, well, he says, you know, since you're so obviously different from my other advisors, I don't see any point in your carrying on. I regard myself as being fired. He says, I resign. But the outcome, and to skip now to 1974, the rate of inflation was 1974 was 14.7%. He'd been driven to prices and incomes control in 1973. And here's where I went wrong. The balance of payments deficit, I said, would be at least £1 billion. At least it was £3.25 billion. It was a disaster. The whole policy was in shambles by 74. However, to go back, he fired me, I say. He said I resigned. So I published this memo in June 1972. And I'd sent it round actually to all my friends in governments before I published it. Sent it to people like Nigel Lawson, Aaron Eve, Sir Keith Joseph and so on. So they knew where I stood. And of course, said Alan was right. And I was. Make no apology for it. I was right because I was applying very simple economic analysis, simple principles on which we could be fairly sure of.
Margaret Thatcher became leader of the Conservative Party in February of 1975. Did you play a role in her general economic education?
Yes, I think so. Not so detailed as some people allege, but I think I did. Because you see, in 1970, when Heath lost the second election in 1974, Keith Joseph and other prominent members of the Conservative Party prevailed upon Heath to do a post-mortem on what went wrong, Keith Joseph in particular. It was quite clear that Heath had lost any sense of reality in that post-mortem, which I attended, incidentally. And he couldn't help but concede that I'd been right on the great inflation of 72. The reasons which I've made perfectly clear. I think she took that very seriously. Certainly Keith Joseph did, and he could be regarded as something like her tutor on economics. But she regarded that very seriously. So I think that was an important element in her education.
Now, the Thatcher rhetoric in the late 70s was very similar to the Heath rhetoric of the late 60s.
Yes, indeed.
How confident were you that this time...
I wasn't. I mean, I thought, oh, my God. You know, if I go back to advisor, and there was all sorts of talk about me going back, you know, what she said is very much like, can we trust her? Literally.
Can we trust her? It was quite risky when you came back in 18.
It was. But two things occurred, really, that brought me back. One was talking to her. She was obviously, you know, quite different from Heath. She was conviction, politician. She had an ideology, a sense of ideas that framed policy. Very different from Heath, number one. Second thing, though, was concrete. When she abolished exchange control in October, I think it was, 1979, that took a lot of moral courage.
So you thought that this was perhaps not as risky as...
It seems to have been, you know, my leader. And subsequently, in 1980, you know, Keith Joseph thought it'd be a good idea if I advised her. And eventually, through the intercession of Alfred Sherman, oddly enough, I decided to come back in early or mid-1980.
So it's hard to remember these days how sick the British economy was. The German ambassador, I remember, said that our economy was like that of East Germany, and the French ambassador said that the British economy was suffering from dégringolade, which is French for falling down sickness. Yeah. It really was a basket case economy, wasn't it?
Oh, it was, yes. I mean, attempts have been made to sort of get rid of the basket, such as Healy in 1976, but it was offset by all the establishment in the Labour Party. So it was in parlous state. By 1979, it really was awful. We had the winter of discontent, piles of garbage in the streets, corpses hanging around because the gravediggers were on strike. I mean, it was a terrible country. And in fact, the country was largely being run by the trade union leaders.
Even after it became clear that she was no Edward Heath, what do you think were the odds were of her pulling off the transformation of the British economy?
I thought the odds were very good after the budget of 1981.
Right.
Up to the budget of 1981, well, I was only been back a short time, seemed to me dodgy. After the budget, literally after the budget, I thought we had a damn good chance of pulling it off.
What was the reaction from the press and your fellow economists on the appointment of you as the Prime Minister's personal economic advisor?
Oh, it varied enormously. On the whole, it was antagonistic, I think, on the balance.
Mrs. Thatcher is reported to have said to you, "Alan, you know what you can do best and you know what needs doing." That's a fantastic job description.
Well, I asked her for my terms of reference, and that's what she replied.
That was her reply to
you? That was her reply. I was expecting a good reply, but not a superb one.
Well, what was it like every day, walking across the park into 10 Downing Street to be advising this remarkable Prime Minister?
Well, it was enormous fun. There's always something coming up. And, you know, one was in a sort of pitch battle all the time, getting her to, you know, her to agree things, and trying to steer departments to produce policies which were generally consistent with the overarching aims of the government. And the personalities were interesting. I was always, of course, prodded by the press, the media generally. And I began, you know, people learned that if they wanted to get through something to Mrs. Thatcher, to the Prime Minister, then it was a good idea to see me first. Now, sometimes people didn't do that, and they ran into heavy weather.
You very soon got a considerable influence on economic policy.
That's right, because they had to get, I mean, all policy really ultimately had to be agreed by the Prime Minister. And I intervened where I thought policy was going wrong, or somebody else wouldn't catch it, or something of the sort.
In your first spell at number 10, the 1981 budget is the defining moment. My understanding is that the issue was that to lower interest rates in the long run, you felt it was essential that the public sector borrowing requirement, the PSBR, be cut. Is that correct?
Yes. The argument was fairly simple. Being simple didn't make it wrong. But it's fairly simple, and it's in terms of, you will recall, my view about fiscal policy, and it was largely perverse, really. So if we tightened fiscal policy, we'd get a positive boost. I'm sorry, if we tightened fiscal policy, we'd get, if anything, a negative boost. But monetary policy was another matter. Monetary policy, by easing monetary policy, we could start the economy rolling. And at the same time, because of the squeeze that had gone on before, we could do it in a non-inflationary way. Now, the state of the fiscal conditions were awful. I mean, they mirrored the piles of garbage in the streets. We had 7% of the GNP had to be borrowed year by year to finance government. And this had gone on for about 7 or 8 years on the average. 7% of GNP had to be borrowed. So that was one of the problems of the fiscal side. So my view was that we should tighten by 3.5%, which is very round about that anyway. Very severe tightening, the most severe tightening in fiscal history that I could see.
There must have been a big debate. Who was on each side?
Oh, well, Mead, Hoskins and Wilson roughly on one side. The rest of the world on the other. It was very much in number 10. I must say, you know, John Hoskins and David Wolfson were splendid. I mean, in essence, I think they did as much for this policy as I did.
And this is the budget of 81 that really laid the foundation.
That's right. Well, you see, it enabled us to bring down interest rates because, you know, once you got a degree of confidence in financial markets, they'd fall. In interest rate would fall there. So we could bring down interest rates. We brought down what was called bank minimum lending rate, I think, in those days. And we brought it down by 200 basis points, by 2%, full 2%. And we brought it down another 2% later. So now that had a much wider effect than ever fiscal policy did. I mean, interest rates go into every equation almost. And bringing interest rates down, and of course bringing the domestic money supply up, because money supply stopped rising completely in 1979.
Now, your response to cut the PSBR in half was denounced in a letter to the Times, dated March the 31st, 1981, by 364 economists, including all living chief economic advisers. How did you react, and did they ever apologise?
The latter, no. Only one journalist said he was wrong, and so far as I can recollect, only one journalist. Well, among those were not just all the economic advisers, two Nobel laureates. The director of the London School of Economics now, virtually all the faculty of economics at Cambridge, all the professors at Cambridge. I mean, it's sort of more interesting to ask who the people who didn't sign it, actually, because there weren't many of them.
Can you remember any who didn't?
Yeah, some who didn't. I mean, firstly, Gorman didn't. Hahn did, though. It's interesting.
Right, he was one of the
marshals of the strike, as it were. Gorman didn't, Ian Little didn't. These are economists who I admire, of course.
But this budget, the 81 budget in which you played such a pivotal role, led to the biggest boom we've ever enjoyed.
Certainly the longest and the biggest, yes. And it laid the foundations for the economy we enjoy today.
What made you leave number 10 after your first stint, and what brought you back later in the 80s?
Well, the reason why I left was I came back to number 10 on a two-year contract. I decided I should only come for 2 years because, you know, if I hung on any further, I feared I would become corrupt.
So you just did 2 years?
Power corrupts, as you know, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So the much more important, though, I entered into an informal contract with my wife that would only go for 2 years, since she had a job in the United States and wanted to come back to it.
In your second spell at number 10 in the late 80s, did you see your primary goal as keeping Sterling out of the ERM?
1989. That was among the reasons I came back. That was one important one, yes. I anticipated Margaret Thatcher would require considerable help
on
the question of ERM membership.
From March 1987 on, Chancellor Lawson was secretly shadowing the Deutschmark, and Margaret Thatcher claims she knew nothing about this until a Financial Times journalist mentioned it to her on November the 20th, I think it was. Is that credible, a Chancellor pursuing a secret policy?
Entirely credible. I mean, prime ministers do other things other than they manage the exchange rate, as it were. Also, you could have a stable exchange rate consistent with the fact that you've not got a target and you're not targeting it. See, the reason when it becomes targeting, you can see then, because there'd be massive interventions, considerable interventions. Well, there weren't many interventions, so far as I can recollect, in those years, in the 87 onwards. And even so, sterling stuck pretty close to the Deutschmark at 3 Deutschmarks per pound.
Why didn't the Prime Minister sack him a lot earlier? She clearly had lost all confidence in him over that last year, both over the inflationary boom and over his secretly tracking the Deutschmark.
Well, I think in 87 it was the possibility of sacking him came up, but he was so popular then. Remember, he was, and rightly so. I mean, his policies had been fairly good, seemed fairly good, anyway, up to then. Well, underlying it, of course, was as fragile as can be. But he was, had enormous political popularity. Deserved much of it, because I think his tax policies were pretty good. His expenditure policies weren't bad. Were pretty good. He'd made amendments to the law which freed up the financial markets quite a lot. Attempted and somewhat succeeded in having a sort of low rates of tax over the system instead of these ridiculous high rates of tax. So there's a lot to be said for him, and he was very popular.
We all knew that ERM was absolutely bound to end in grief. I mean, it was quite clear. Why couldn't you not convince her of the general case?
You say we all knew? Nobody knew. I mean, I was vilified as an opponent of Britain entering the ERM. I mean, you remember I was called Rasputin by some Briton, the most distinguished economist. I mean, the vast majority of the academic profession thought we should join the ERM. So, I was in very much a minority. But even, and I think certainly, this was made plain that there's a majority in cabinet for it.
The events of this extraordinary day are all the more remarkable because for most of it appeared to be very much business as usual. John Major, for one, arriving at cabinet this morning, certainly didn't know he'd have another new job by nightfall. But we now know that an hour and a half before cabinet at 10:30, Mr. Lawson had already had the first of his three meetings with the Prime Minister in her study at Downing Street. At that meeting, he told Mrs. Thatcher he was on the point of resigning. The reason? The Prime Minister's refusal to sack this man, her economic adviser, Sir Alan Walters. Yet just 2 days ago, Mr. Lawson appeared to have won that battle with a deal over Sir Alan's future silence.
Well, it's not a question of division between me and Sir Alan Walters. I am the Chancellor of the Exchequer. He is an advisor, a part-time advisor. He gives advice, and a whole lot of other people give advice too. A whole lot of civil servants who give advice. But ultimately, it is ministers who take decisions.
Did you deliberately leak material to the Financial Times, as he claims?
The thing he's talking about here is something I was alleged to have said to the Financial Times in October, or end of September, or early October, 1989. This was an article I wrote, which is a sort of little autobiography. And I'd written it in at least a year before. And it didn't get published for a year for various reasons. Now, what had happened when the news of my reappointment occurred, came out, in whenever it was. This is in 89, we're talking about now. I was sitting in my office with my old colleague Ezra Bernathan, and the Financial Times rang me and said, would you like to say what your views are on this, that and the other? And I said, well, no, because I've got other things to do. I haven't got time. But I said, I've written an article, a little autobiography, over a year ago, and handed it over. Now, in that article, I said I thought the ERM was half-baked. And that's true. I mean, I've argued it's half-baked. I think it was half-baked. This was translated into me giving a press conference saying that the RM was rubbish, half-baked, and we should have nothing to do with it. That view was, of course, contrary to government's policy. I never said anything of the kind. I never gave a press conference. Never even saw anybody from the press. But I had written this article a year before I came back to number 10. And I stood by it and still stand by it today.
Mrs. Thatcher's views on ERM at the time seemed clear enough. She said, for example, there's no way in which one can buck the market. And she later said it was a folly of regarding a particular exchange rate parity as the criterion for political and economic success.
She had a difficult road there. She was absolutely clear in the ERM, followed my advice to the letter from the original paper I wrote in 1981 on this issue. She was perfectly clear, but she was sandbagged by Howe, Lawson, miscellaneous others in the cabinet, who said to her, and I've heard them say this, Lawson said this, look, Margaret, here you are, your two chief ministers are in favour of entering the ERM. They've considered it carefully and deeply. Their departments have spent a lot of time on this. How can you oppose them? And her answer was, I oppose you because you're wrong. And she was quite right.
You did write a famous paper for her called When the Time Will Be Ripe, about your conditions for entry to ERM. What were those?
Well, my conditions were designed so that there were unimpeachable economic conditions, but you could always use them to stay out of the ERM.
Well, no exchange controls,
no exchange controls,
deregulation.
Complete deregulation of financial markets. We still haven't got that.
What made Chancellor Lawson so dramatically say to the Prime Minister in October 89, only 5 months after your return, it's either sack Walters or I go?
I'm imputing things here which I have not checked, but as you'd imagine, he'd come to terms then with the fact that his policy since 1986, really, when he started, seven when he actually shadowed it, it was a disaster. Interest rates had gone up to 15%. You know, this is the opposite of 1981. There was at least all the elements of overheating and a crash coming. So I think by that time he knew that the thing had gone wrong. He could stay to put it right, or he could resign, or look for a reason to resign.
You could argue that it was really quite an easy decision for her. You know, on the one hand, she completely lost confidence in her chancellor over the past 11 months because of his secret economic policy. And on the other hand, she describes you as being devoted and loyal, who had always given frank and good advice. Was it an easy decision for her?
I think it was impossible to stick with me and let him resign. The reason is political. He had great support in the cabinet, remember. I mean, curious kind of support, but anyway, great support in the cabinet. I think it would have been impossible for the sort of arrangement where I stayed in the advisory role.
Because when he resigned, you immediately
resigned,
saying that...
It was a position where we had to clean the slate and start again.
Many people have said there are two sides to Margaret Thatcher's management style, the intuitive on the one hand and the highly analytical on the other hand. Is that correct?
There's something in that, you know. I mean, intuitively, she was a great intuitive economist. You know, if she saw an economic problem, she'd say, well, that's what we should do. Nine times out, maybe eight times out of ten, she's right. In other words, she's something of a natural economist. And there are very few natural economists
in the world.
Yes, well, able to instinctively get the right solution without going through all the analysis. I think one is, of course, Milton Friedman. I don't think I am, oddly enough. I think I have to go through the rigmarole.
If you had persevered and stayed with the Prime Minister and won the ERM debate, then we wouldn't have joined.
No.
There'd been no Black Wednesday. no complete loss of Tory credibility, and perhaps no change of government, no Tony Blair.
Well, I think that's right. I think she, the RM decision, in my view, destroyed the Conservative Party. They'll never, I think probably in my lifetime anyway, recover their reputation for financial discipline. I mean, they were shown to be, all running in September the 16th, 1992, when they fell out of the RM, they were running around like Keystone Cops, falling over themselves. Interest rates were going up, interest rates were going down. We're in the RM, no, we're out of the RM. And people looked at that and said, where's the Conservative Party we used to know?
In May of 1990, in your book, Sterling in Danger, you predicted that ERM would end in chaos.
Yes, indeed. It was because ERM, by fixing interest rates at the level of Germany, induced the wrong monetary policies. As some countries, such as Britain, wanted higher interest rates, other countries wanted lower interest rates. Now, you're creating conditions there where the domestic policies of these countries are the opposite of what they require. And of course, it couldn't go on. And it's bound to end in a breakdown, a breakout. But it's bound to end in the parities of the RM coming loose. And that's what we saw, of course, in September the 16th in 1992, just about a couple of years after I wrote those words.
You're very good at this prediction stuff. Let me ask you, what do you see for the future of monetary union?
I think it will go on for, roughly speaking, at least 5 years.
That too will end in tears?
Then I think the strains will begin to tell, and it will end in tears eventually again. The reason for believing it will go on for 5 years is because there's been an enormous investment of political capital in this. They'll try and keep it going. Now, of course, the union is ridiculous in its policies. Ireland has inflation rates of 6.5-7%. Asset price inflation, inflation of houses in Ireland is probably 20%. And that's being teamed with a country like France, which has inflation rate of 1.5%. Ireland needs a high interest rate, France needs a low interest rate, but they can't. They have to have one. And that's stupid. Stupid policies induced by this monetary union.
You once described Terence Gorman as, and I'll quote you here, the only obvious genius I've ever encountered in the economics profession. It's very high praise.
Absolutely justified too, in my view. He'd got a superb brain. He was a man who could look over your shoulder at what you were doing, where you were working out something you thought was very complicated, and say, bum, 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 that's it. It's very quick, very broad brain too, in fact. He was very knowledgeable about all sorts of things, everything you could imagine, really. Yet he had this analytical ability, which was, as I say, beyond anything I've seen elsewhere.
You first met Milton Friedman in 1954,
he came from
Cambridge to give a paper at Birmingham.
That's right, yeah.
What did you make of Milton?
I thought he was the greatest thing since the proverbial sliced bread. His paper was on the permanent income hypothesis, you know, the consumption function. But he stated the hypothesis beautifully, shorn it down, said this is a simple hypothesis. But the real genius was he brought in evidence from all sorts of places to bear on this and interpreted it in a brilliant way. And you see, I believe it was his greatest work.
Tell us about your friendship with Peter Bauer.
Peter Bauer voted on my appointment as, of course, a professor at LSE. And he voted, he said, with some reluctance, because he thought that since I was being promoted by Hahn and Gorman, the mathematician side, and the econometric side too, he had grave doubts about whether I would be, a proper economist. but it didn't take as long to get together and realise we had similar approaches anyway. I had some specialism on the quantitative side. Peter had it on the sort of scholarship side. So we got on very well, and we wrote, as I say, I think we wrote perhaps four articles together.
And Frank Hahn, of course, whom you admired so much at Birmingham, was one of the ringleaders of the infamous 364 who wrote that letter to the Times in March of 1981. That must have hurt a little.
Not really. I mean, you know, we could take different views on these things. Frank knew my view. He knew my views about the inefficacy of fiscal policy. So fiscal policy is for the birds. He said fiscal policy is all that matters, really. Monetary policy is handmaiden. So it was on that issue we differed, and my policies differed. He saw me afterwards, and he came to see me just about that time. He came to see me in number 10 and complained I didn't take account of fiscal policy and how disastrous this would be. So, well, we'll see, won't we? We did.
Your entry in Who's Who in Economics, where you were invited to write your own entry, in fact, concludes with the following words. I've recently been concerned with the state of economics, particularly macro, and the advice which economists can, with good conscience, give.
Well, we don't know. Macroeconomics is in an awful state. I mean, we don't know anything about the dynamics of it, really. I mean, if we were good at macroeconomics, we could predict exchange rates. Can you find economists who've predicted exchange rates? It's a very, very, very tedious search, I can assure you. I've got the exchange rate right on occasions. I've got it wrong on occasions. I wouldn't want to put my money on me.
Tell us a story of your work on what you called consistent expectations.
Well, this was actually... In 1969, I formed the view that we could develop expectations by developing the forecasts of a theory and finding expectations which were consistent with that theory. If you hold the theory, then you'd hold these expectations. It had been done, it had been tried in agricultural economics, but I was the first to apply it to macroeconomics. These were developed later. They were called rational expectations, which is, I think, the wrong word for it. Consistent expectations, or expectations which are consistent with the theory you hold. So it's internally consistent. I worked on that and wrote an article in the Economic Journal, 1971, I think it was. I concluded when I'd done this that they were subject to the Eisenberg principle. Eisenberg is, you know, you can't observe anything without affecting it. Mm-hmm. And I gave up. Now, the consistent or rational expectations were adopted by Chicago and Minnesota and made a great development of it, enormous development. Still goes with us today. I think suffered some eclipse, but not much.
In 1989, Rupert Penn-and-Ray, then editor of The Economist, was very dismissive of you and stated something on the following lines, that you were arguably among the best 300 transport economists in the world.
This is an insult I treasure. You know, these are the very few insults you treasure, but I do treasure this one.
It's a very British kind of put-down, isn't it?
Well, it tells you much more about the putter-down than the put-down. And the reason he said this was he wanted to insult me because I was advising Margaret Thatcher to stay out of the RM. And he was a keen ERMer, as was The Economist, as was virtually everybody. And he was saying that, you know, but for this 300 transport economists, we would be in the RM. He was quite right, too.
You've said that Arthur Seldon at the IEA was the best editor you've ever had in your long career, and you clearly admire also his co-worker, Ralph Harris. Would you like to say a word or two about their work over the past 40 years?
Oh, yes, they've been splendid. I mean, Ralph as the promoter has been wonderful. His personality, his general bonhomie, and his deep knowledge, people forget this, his deep knowledge of the history of thought, particularly of Adam Smith and so on. No, it's ideal for that job. Arthur, the, well, as I say, he was a superb editor. He'd catch everything and catch inconsistencies in the text. I don't know how he did it, actually, but he's a born, I think if editors are born, he's a born editor.
And what of...
very agreeable editor. I must say, a very agreeable editor. You could argue with him and win your point. But nevertheless, he was superb.
What do you think has been your greatest single contribution in the academic field?
Oh, dear, I think probably... in the micro field, pricing policy, yes. That had a lot, and cost-benefit analysis, that had a large number of implications. In macroeconomics, the downgrading of fiscal policy, elevation of monetary policy, as we proved in, you know, the 81.
Mm-hmm. And in the policy world, what has been your greatest single contribution, do you think? Or would you list
I think I've been a disaster. I think I failed in policy terms because I didn't get Margaret Thatcher to stay out of the ERM. Nor did I get her to not sign the Single European Act. The fact that I didn't sit on my hands, but I didn't engage myself enthusiastically in that. The ERM, yes, I did. I went right down the line there, got fired for my pains. But and I think Margaret Thatcher would say the two mistakes she made was signing the Single European Act and entering the ERM, and I agree with her. And I could have done, if I had have conducted myself differently, I could have done much to at least delay that, if not stop it entirely.
You've also written that you had a relative advantage over colleagues because you seem to be the only one with the data handling tools who was both distilling all the empirical implications of a theoretical principle and seeking data to bring to bear on the propositions at hand. For example, you use data from traffic engineers to compute marginal social costs and then from that get the best congestion tax.
Yes, this is a runoff from Friedman because that's what he does. You know, you look all over for various places and you say, well, that has implications for this theory. So you bring this body of data, body of analysis, into analyse something which was quite different. Because, for instance, in my initial work on pricing, on road pricing and congestion, I used hydrodynamic models and then later thermodynamic models because I saw them very similar, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Traffic going down the road is rather similar to water going down a tube or fluids going down tubes. So I used that sort of work which had been done in that sort of field. I found it, it's rather like a detective looking for clues and gathering them in the most unlikely places.
What is the future for the ideals that you hold so dear, the ideals of a liberal society based on markets, private property rights and the rule of law?
I'm frightened of them. I mean, I know we've seen the great resuscitation of markets over the last 20 years or so. I'm afraid that we see, more realistically, closer to, we see a number of ways in which that rise is being, the rise of the markets is being not merely contained but reversed. In the UK, I believe that's the case too. So I think we're probably at the apotheosis of the market, and I'm worried about that.
Where do you see the threats coming from?
The so-called third wayers will quickly become, you know, socialists again. From Europe, particularly France, if we go further, much further into the European Union, France is the real danger in my view.
So would it be true to say we've won the battle with communism, but we're losing the battle with creeping regulation?
That's right, creeping regulation and creeping socialism.
What do you think gave you the confidence to be right on occasions when academic and other opinion was so strongly ranged against you?
Well, the work I'd done, I'd worked on it. You see, they paid little attention to me, although I published a lot of articles, so they were published because substantially they were right. you know, they're academically right. So I'd published a lot of these, but people don't want to believe that. You can imagine, can you, all these guys who spent their lives learning Keynes, learning about market, you know, capital markets and so on, they've got enormous investment there, enormous capital. Now I come along and say, ha ha, it's all wrong, throw that away. Very difficult for academics or anybody else to throw capital away over which they've slaved for years, where they've put their heart and soul into these things. Then I come along with the result which says it ain't so. So of course you're wrong, okay, no, get out of the way.
What's the single most important lesson you've learned as an economist over the last 5 decades?
To think the damn thing through and never give up. And never be afraid of running against the pack. It's anxiety not to do wrong, you know, if you know what I mean, to get things wrong. Hammer out till you get things right. And you can test it, try it, look at it, walk round it, give it a kick up the backside, but make sure it's right. For instance, this is certainly true in both pricing work and the budget, fiscal work and so on, and monetary work. I had to make sure it was robust. The last thing I wanted to do was sell people a bill of goods when I hadn't got a robust system of thought behind it. And on the whole, that's served me quite well, I think.
Well, thank you very much indeed. It's been most interesting. Thank you.
Thank you for grilling me so pleasantly.